The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larson, Judge Johnson, and Judge Smith. The Honorable Elise L. Larson presiding.
Good almost afternoon, counsel. Just for the audio record, today is September 15th, and this hearing is being held by Zoom.gov. An audio recording of today's hearing will be available on the court's website. I would observe for the attorneys that the time clock should be visible if you use the gallery view setting on Zoom. And I would remind you to please mute your microphone when you are not speaking. With that, I will call our fourth case today. The case number is A21-1575, State of Minnesota versus Christopher Lee Konakowitz. Almost afternoon, counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
You've each been allotted 15 minutes for oral argument, and appellants, you will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. For both of you, please, before beginning your argument, identify yourself and your client for the audio record. And with that, Ms. Olson, are you prepared to start?
I am, Your Honor. Good morning, judges, opposing counsel. May it please the court. My name is Michelle Olson, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Konakowitz, in this matter. We are asking the court to find the errors within the trial and to completely reverse and apply double jeopardy to the case due to a lack of sufficiency of evidence, or in the alternative, to remand for a new trial. And the reason why we are asking that is because there have been three major issues. The first is relating to the sufficiency of the evidence. In reviewing the record, there is not sufficient evidence to sustain the conviction. Under Minnesota law, there is the standard for sufficiency of the evidence is basically a decision to determine whether or not the facts on the record with the legitimate inferences can conclude reasonably that a jury could find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Mr. Konakowitz understands that the evidence must be viewed in the light most favorable to what the jury found and disbelieve contrary evidence from. However, in reviewing the file, there isn't a lot of evidence that is in dispute, meaning there isn't a lot of contrary evidence from defense versus the state. Most of the evidence that had been provided was by the state, and in reviewing the evidence for the jury to find this conviction in reviewing the light most favorable, it would have to make several logical leaps that would not be appropriate under the standard. Specifically, the major witness in the case was the alleged victim, Miss Bethany Konakowitz, and her statements throughout the trial had been contradictory with other statements from other testimony within a CHIPS file, as well as, frankly, her statements to the officers.
Ms. Olson, assuming even if there were contradictory statements for sufficiency of the evidence, are you saying that there was never a point at which, for example, trial testimony, that the victim testified as to penetration, that in fact penetration occurred? Because obviously we're not going to resolve contradictory evidence on appeal, as you know. So are you saying there's no evidence whatsoever?
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the statement that was made by Ms. Konakowitz at trial of penetration was specifically based on the prosecution's definition of penetration and their implication that what that could mean. It was not that she herself remembered that penetration had occurred or identified it at any point with prior to the trial itself. It actually had occurred during the trial testimony that was the first incident or time it came up. Prior to that, and regarding the state's other witness, Deputy Reed, that never happened. That was never discussed. Penetration never was considered or officially determined that had occurred. And that is based on the record and the testimony of Deputy Reed that no, there wasn't really considered penetration in there. And that's why the statements are so confusing and why you would have to make such a logical leap, including ignoring the testimony of Ms. Konikowicz in her prior testimony, as well as her own statements to the officers. What is happening here is the jury would have to completely disregard Ms. Konikowicz, find that those statements were not credible, but this particular statement was. And that is a leap that should not be allowed. Because again, what we're saying is we're allowing a singular witness to have completely contradictory statements, and yet that could create a legitimate reason for finding for this conviction. And that just seems to be implausible for the facts on this record. Now, there may be other situations where that could occur, but not with the facts that are before the court and the record in this matter. Specifically, Ms. Konikowicz's statements were that touching may have occurred, which would potentially lead to a different conclusion, but the jury found that didn't happen, that there was first degree criminal sexual conduct, which includes penetration and coercion. And again, the issue we run into is the legal definitions that are used were not particularly testified to. And what is happening is that there is a lot of implication based more on age, and the Spriegel evidence seems to be used as a bolster for Ms. Konikowicz's testimony versus actual evidence that the action occurred. So
Ms. Olson, is it settled law in Minnesota what penetration is under the definition of penetration under the statute?
Your Honor, I believe I'm trying to find it within my brief to make sure I'm stating it correctly. I believe that penetration has been defined through Minnesota case law. Do I think it's explicitly settled that it couldn't be expanded? No, but there has been definitions of what acts could be considered penetration, which would be an intrusion, however slight, into the genital or anal openings. That includes digital intrusion, which would be fingers. And I believe that is Minnesota State Statute 609.341, subdivision 12.2. I know it is also been defined under State v. Barber, which was a Minnesota Court of Appeals 1993 case, which is 494 Northwest 2nd, 497 at 503. And the Minnesota Supreme Court denied review. So that is my understanding, is kind of the general definition of penetration. And that is the definition that would have been properly used in this matter.
Yeah. So it would be your position that, you know, sort of case law from other jurisdictions that says, you know, penetration of the labia is penetration for the purposes of this would not be the appropriate definition?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that you should not be using the outside definitions, because that was not determined by the district court judge that an expansion should occur. And Minnesota case law that is precedential does not include that. It could have included it. It does not here. So it should not be further expanded, at least without the district court having applied that it should be, because then what would be happening is the Court of Appeals would be making a sua sponte ruling that was not determined within the district court. And that, again, is part of why we are asking for a reversal, because the jury made an assumption based on a definition that is not occurred in law and was not stated in the jury's instructions. It did not specifically state that touching the labia or opening the labia would be considered sexual penetration under Minnesota law. it was very specific under our current case law what would be considered. If that is something that an expansion should be requested, then that would be something the district court should have made a determination on, but not here under the record we have. Further, again, this goes towards the issues that we have of such contradictory testimony. What the jury would have had to do is completely ignore officer or deputy Reed's, reports and kind of the investigation, because again, in his investigation, she never commented that penetration had occurred the way it had. Further, Ms. Konikowicz had made additional claims and allegations that weren't under the original investigation that seemed to have spontaneously come up at trial, which created several issues. And part of that, I believe, is because of the other defects within the trial, which would be the Spriegel evidence that had been admitted, as well as the fact that the charges are so late. This is not a situation where we have, you know, recent charge. This child is younger, but, you know, it's fairly recent. This is an incident where the allegation is this happened to a 5-year-old, and 20 years later now is making claims against my client. The reason why we don't allow for that, and we have statute of limitations and we have such strong statute of limitations, is for this very reason. We now have significant contradictions within the key witness's testimony that can't be necessarily contradicted, because if she makes these statements at trial, there's no way to investigate it. You are at trial. You are stuck with now what she has said, and the contradictory testimony that she has created seems to have been completely ignored by the jury, which would not be proper. Again, you'd have to completely say she lied or she made something up or we don't believe her on this situation. But here today, what she's saying is truthful. And that is such a large logical leap that it would not be appropriate. And I don't believe upon an objective review that there is legitimate inferences that could be made to say she didn't lie here, but she lied here. That would be the leap that has to be made because they are so contradictory from each other. Now, regarding the Spriegel evidence, if you were to find that there is sufficiency of the evidence, we still think that there were some issues at trial. Specifically, the Spriegel evidence seemed to have been used to bolster Ms. Konikowicz's claim. It was not decided at the trial. In fact, there was a motion prior to it where evidence was being offered and the court preliminarily allowed it in, but did cite some concerns he had regarding it and that further review at trial was necessary. However, that further review never occurred. Specifically with Spriegel evidence, typically it is allowed in if it's clear and convincing, it's relevant and material, and it's more probative than prejudicial. And under the balance, there needs to be a precise identified fact to show why it would be relevant. Under this particular case, they use the common scheme and plan exception for the Spriegel evidence. However, the plan similarities aren't there. Besides the fact the age and the time frame, that is the only similarity of the alleged acts that occurred here and the conviction in which they were using the evidence. It was not the same, home in which the crime occurred. There was no connection or relation to the witness with the other alleged victim. There was no reason to presume that because the person was the alleged victim was 5 at the time, and then the time frame, therefore that must create the same modus or common scheme. And the reason why we don't have that is because of this situation where we are saying, well, because this happened to someone else, therefore it must have happened here, and we want to present that evidence to provide this plan. However, there should be more. There should have been more similarities. In this situation, we have technically no penetration. if you follow the reports and what was alleged originally prior to the Spriegel evidence being allowed in, there had been no penetration, where in the other case there had been. The situation was it was a non-family member versus technically a family member. In this situation, the incidents occurred in other family members' homes. Part of the allegation was that in the 2001 matter, that there was a babysitting or some type of authority figure, where in this instance, Mr. Konecoats had never had that babysitting specifically related to the incidents which had been charged. He was not watching her. He was not supposed to be taking care of her. That wasn't the same. Yet we're using this vague two kind of similarities to qualify and require or allow Spriegel in. And there needs to be something more to establish that. I mean, that would be the barest minimum. And the whole point of having not allowing Spriegel evidence is because it can be extremely prejudicial. We use the evidence carefully because it helps to make determinations with the jury. But in this case, what it does is basically enhances Ms. Konecoats' claim because the time frame was similar and it was around the same time and it was around the same age. And that is why it is, and I see my time is up. May I finish my sentence?
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. That is why we don't allow such basic, plain similarities to be allowed under the common scheme. There needs to be something more. We have some pretty clear distinctions on what needs to be happened so that we don't use this evidence improperly, that we're using it for that purpose of helping the jury, but not in replace of their own good judgment and understanding of that particular case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Green, are you prepared to start your argument?
Yes. And yes, I am also Jill Jensen.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jill Green now, and I represent the state of Minnesota. I want to first turn to the insufficiency of evidence argument. There were several questions and assumptions that what the legal definition was that was provided to Ms. Konecoats. And I would agree that the statutory legal definition is for penetration is intrusion into the genital opening, however slight. There is no indication in here that an explanation of case law indicating that going through the outer folds of the labia or vulva, though I do argue it in the alternative, there is no indication that that was provided to Ms. Konecoats. And in fact, if you look at page 293 of the transcript, Ms. Konecoats herself provides what her understanding of the description of penetration is. Specifically, she says, when asked, and to be clear, did he ever enter you? Because she had stated he rubbed his hands between my labia and towards my vaginal opening. She was asked, did he ever enter you? She said, I think there was slight penetration. I know penetration with his fingers could be anything from, a quarter inch to 3 inches. I don't think it ever got that far, but from what I remember, yes, slightly. So it is very clear from this statement that Ms. Konecoats is using the legal definition or her understanding of it.
Ms. Green, is the term, excuse me, now I'm looking for it, genital opening equivalent to the opening of the vagina, or is genital opening, if that term is used, is that broader?
I don't know that genital opening is defined explicitly, and I could be wrong. It appears fairly clear to me that she is referring to the vaginal opening, which case law and I think statute is explicit with or is the same as genital opening. I argue in the alternative because there is case law in Minnesota that says the genital opening on a female which constitutes the vulva, which is the opening, and which is the outer external genitalia of the woman, which includes the labial folds and the would constitute penetration of the genital opening. I don't think it's defined, but I don't think Your Honors, when deciding this issue, even need to get there. I agree that she described that he was penetrating the external genitalia and touching the vaginal opening, but she also did testify that he did penetrate her, however slight, and she explained that her understanding of penetration was a quarter of an inch to 3 inches, and that penetration occurred. And so that by itself would be sufficient to for the jury to conclude there is or to convict Mr. Konikowitz.
Just so I'm clear, in your latter references, you're referring to penetration of the vagina or the vaginal opening? Or I mean, was that her testimony explicitly?
That was my understanding of her testimony. When she's asked, she explicitly references him touching her vaginal opening. And then there's follow-up questions about if he entered her. And she said, yes. So. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And just to be clear, even if that, was there other testimony relative to labia, et cetera, that in itself would have satisfied the legal standard, in your view, a sufficient evidence to satisfy that standard, even if there was not testimony relative to the vaginal opening? In other words, is the other testimony about, you know, falling apart and where he was touching, et cetera, constituted sufficient evidence to satisfy the statutory standard?
I think her statement that he penetrated her is sufficient to satisfy the statutory standard. And I apologize, I might be misunderstanding your question.
Oh, I just meant if there were some, there, she also talked about, I think there was testimony looking through, I'm quoting, looking through my labia, spread them apart and everything, then, you know, touching my vaginal opening, whether that in itself would be sufficient under the definition of penetration of a.
Well, if you're referring to the statutory definition, I think I would also look to the case law that seems to illuminate that that is sufficient going in between the folds, specifically in Champ. And I would also point to the fact that the victim very clearly testified multiple times that his hands were all over her vagina, in between her labia. And then she said there was penetration, slight penetration. So I think that in itself, the jury can reasonably infer that for slight penetration, she's referring to her vaginal or genital opening, because it would not be slight penetration if you're referring to your external genitalia and his hands are all over in between looking for toilet paper, touching your vaginal opening. I think a common sense interpretation would lead a jury not to think that she was referring to slight penetration of her vulva or labia. So for those reasons, I think there's more than sufficient evidence. Counsel in this case is essentially asking this court to reweigh contradictory testimony. And as the court had stated, that's not the province of this court. The fact finder is in the best seat to do that. That testimony, those prior statements, that prior testimony, the victim was confronted with that. She was impeached with that. That is the purpose of prior inconsistent statements. It happens all the time. And the jury is in the best seat to weigh the credibility. Even the district court stated at a certain point that he felt the victim explained quite well why her testimony had changed, because she understood penetration to be a substantial amount. I think she said approximately 3 inches of incursion into her genital area, genital opening, and didn't understand that any intrusion, however slight, into the genital opening constituted penetration legally. And so for those reasons, I think there's more than sufficient evidence here for this court to affirm the convictions, particularly viewing all the testimony and evidence in the light most favorable to the state and the jury. I just don't think there's really any other reasonable conclusion. As to the court's admission of Spriegel evidence, I'd ask that this court find that the district court did not abuse its discretion in admitting Spriegel evidence. At the outset, I would just factually correct the record to state that the court did not say further review was necessary. The court said it was willing to take another review of it, but no party requested it. The court went through an extensive and thorough evaluation of the five factors of Spriegel evidence, including the purpose for which it is offered, which I understand appellant to be contesting the common scheme and plan. And in this case, there are several cases, as stated in the state's brief, that demonstrate that these victims are similarly situated. It's not the same general crime. These are both five-year-old children that Mr. Konikowicz, or the appellant, sexually assaulted by touching the vaginal area when they were isolated. These were both occurred in Brown County. These both occurred during the same time period. These both occurred when he was alone with them and in his own residence at the time. But nonetheless, the result of the proceed, the appellant has not established that the result of the proceeding would have been any different. The state noted, this would be likely admissible as relationship evidence. And not only that, in these criminal sexual conduct cases, particularly delayed disclosures, it's so often a he said, she said type of case. And in this case, there's a direct witness. The victim's father came forward and actually caught the appellant in the middle of the act in the boat with the tarp. Particularly, he corroborated the victim's testimony that they were in the boat under the tarp, and the appellant had pulled down her panties and was looking at her vagina at that time, which corroborates very key aspects of the victim's testimony that, yes, he forced her knees apart pretended as though he was looking for toilet paper, cleaning for toilet paper in particular. She said he was looking for toilet paper in her vaginal opening, which again is helpful for this court to find the evidence was sufficient. So for those reasons, even if there's not a likelihood that even if that prior Spriegel act had not been introduced, that the result of the proceeding would have been different. I'd also point out that there is, let me move on to the next couple because I'm running out of time and there's 4 minutes left. And there are two further arguments, which were the statute of limitations and whether the state delayed charging. The appellant in this case took a polygraph exam in 2008 in connection with probation for her prior sexual misconduct. He disclosed an individual named Ann on that polygraph, and he alleged that that was a report to law enforcement authorities. The district court held a contested hearing and found that a probation officer is not a law enforcement authority. This is consistent with the testimony of both the probation agent and law enforcement agencies, as well as this court's prior decisions indicating that a prosecutor and a human services agency is not a law enforcement authority. But nonetheless, even if
this court— Can I ask a question because I don't know the answer. Are probation officers mandated reporters? I mean, I know that, right, there's some careers that you have where people are mandated reporters and they're required to tell law enforcement when, you know, they think that child abuse is occurring. Maybe it's a question without a difference, but I find the fact sort of interesting that law enforcement didn't get informed after the report.
So the report was made in 2008, and it was all of this had purportedly occurred before his first conviction was in 2001. As a mandated reporter, you're only required to report under 260E.06 subdivision one. You're only required to report if the child is currently being maltreated or has been maltreated within the past 3 years. So even if the probation officer were a mandated reporter, he would not be mandated to report that. And I think that could also just pose an interesting question for the future for probation officers reviewing polygraph reports. But nonetheless, law enforcement didn't have it. And for those reasons, the state did not just delay charging. And moreover, there has to be a showing that the state intentionally delayed it in order to gain a tactical advantage. And that has not been established at all here. And that is one piece of the two pieces that need to be established in order for a due process violation to occur. So for those reasons, I'd ask that this court dismiss that argument as well. And then I think I skipped over the sufficiency of evidence conviction as to coercion and force. And I would just, obviously, the parties both briefed this extensively. However, there's a very similar case and testimony in this case to indicate that the appellant created an atmosphere of fear and used physical force. He took this child and isolated her in a boat under a tarp. The child was 5 years old. She described her weight and height, which was quite small. She described the appellant's stature, which was that of a grown man. She described how she actually realized it was wrong and held her knees together and he forced them apart. And for all those reasons, there's sufficient evidence for a jury to infer that there is coercion. And so for all the reasons that I've discussed and that are written in the state's brief, I'd request that this court uphold the convictions and dismiss this appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Olson, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to get towards this penetration and the witness's understanding of what it meant, specifically because that seems to be the key fact in what the jury found created enough evidence for the conviction. On page 317 of the trial transcript, Mr. Hagen, which is appellant's trial counsel, asked Ms. Konikowitz specifically, I think your testimony was something along the lines of not at that time, and he is asking her regarding penetration and the legal definition. And Ms. Konikowitz says, yeah, I didn't know the legal definition of penetration until recently. And then it goes on to say, who told you the legal definition? And it's Ms. Jensen. That's what she says. And so the issue we run into is Ms. Konikowitz had no idea whether or not she had been penetrated. She actually didn't know. She describes an incident, but that does not mean she understood that penetration occurred or she could testify to that penetration. She can describe what happened and then say, this is what occurred. The jury could have maybe made a determination, but she specifically says, yes, I was penetrated. And I was penetrated because that's what this means. She didn't base it on her own actual conclusion. She based it on the conclusions of what the prosecutor decided what the legal definition of sexual penetration is. And as it is clear in case law that sexual penetration does not say between the labia. It's very clear it is in the genital opening, which would be the vaginal opening of the child in this instance.
And what is that case law that you're saying? So I can look at that.
I'm basing it, Your Honor, on the definition of sexual penetration, which I believe is State v. Baker, as well as the statute. It doesn't specifically say, it says genital opening, and the genital opening would be the vaginal opening. That seems to be the more proper standard.
Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, this is an important question because when I look at the testimony, even testimony that's not using the word penetration, I think she testified, was looking through my labia, spreading them apart and everything, and then, you know, touching my vaginal opening. And you're saying there is case law that would preclude that from being penetration. What is that case law?
Your Honor, it is in my brief, and just give me one moment. I want to make sure I'm citing to it correctly. Specifically, it's an intrusion, however in slight, into the genital or anal openings. And that is defined, like I said, under Minnesota Statute 609.341 subdivision 12.2. State v. Barber also defines it under the same way. So I believe that it had been codified that way.
Right. That's what's important is you are saying that the case law and the statutory definition equates genital opening with vaginal opening, and that contact, and that there needs to be an intrusion, a vaginal intrusion, right? Is that what I'm understanding your argument to be? And that it cannot include, for example, spreading, looking through my labia and spreading them apart and everything, and then, you know, touching my vaginal opening, that would not suffice in that case law. Case law would preclude that from being penetration of a genital opening.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the case law that you say is Barber. That's where we should look.
State v. Barber defines it similar to the statute. And the reason why I'm saying it would not be considered penetration is because you do not have the intrusion into the vaginal area based on her testimony. I do not dispute that she says that he spread her labia and looked at the vaginal opening and touched it, but that is not an intrusion. It is specific. Similarly, would be if someone touched someone's anus but doesn't intrude on it, that is not sexual penetration. It could be considered something else, a different criminal sexual conduct, but it is not the same thing. Similarly, the vaginal opening would make sense. It would be a similar situation. That is why we are saying there isn't enough evidence. And I see my time is up. May I finish?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. The legal definitions are very, very specific. And the reason why we have them specific is because we have different levels of criminal sexual conduct that may have been charged based on those specific actions. In this case, first degree criminal sexual conduct requires the sexual penetration, or the alternative was force and coercion. In this case, we don't have either of those two legally defined by statute, which I have briefed pretty extensively, and I know opposing counsel has also briefed. Thank you.
Thank you so much, counsel, for your argument.